So we continue our study tonight in the book of James in chapter 2. We're getting near the end of that section of the second half of the chapter. There's pretty much a natural division really at the halfway point in James chapter 2. We had 13 verses of the first half, and then there's 13 verses of the second half. Not that the subjects are completely disjointed, unrelated, and that they don't, that there's no context that continues in any way, but there is a distinction there in the two halves of James chapter 2, with the first half having the subject of being a respecter of faces, or that we are taught not to be. And then the second half of the chapter is about having a faith that works, a living faith. Now, just to show that this is, or to remind ourselves of how this is not just suddenly 13 verses that are just placed here in the second half of James 2 that are that's disconnected from the rest of the book. I mean, he's really going back to the subject that was at the latter part of chapter 1 when we started in verse 22 of chapter 1, where he told us to be what and not what. Doers and not hearers only. So there are two necessary components in order for us to, as he leads it down to the end of that chapter, to be able to practice pure and undefiled religion before God. That we have to be a hearer and a doer. And if we only hear and don't do, then we're not going to be practicing pure religion and undefiled before God. Our religion then will be vain, as he put it there. So those are the two necessary components in chapter 1. Well, we had hear and do. Now in the second half of James 2, we have faith and works. Are those similar topics? Are those points similar at all, or is that something that's unrelated? Well, where the faith that he's speaking about here in James 2, where does that faith come from? According to the scriptures, where do we get faith from? Now, if we're speaking about faith in general, not, faith is belief. Well, there's lots of things we can believe, right? In fact, there are lots of things we believe. There are lots of things everybody believes. You ever met a person that just does not believe anything? I mean, that doesn't exist. And people who mock faith in religion, they're ones that describe themselves as being atheists or agnostics, and they'll mock our faith. But do they have a system of belief? Yeah. I mean, do atheists believe anything? Well, they believe that everything came from nothing. Don't they? If there's no God that made everything, then everything that exists had to ultimately come from nothing. They have to believe that, don't they? I mean, you either believe that everything that exists, I mean, you're either going to deny that and say, well, nothing exists. I mean, nobody's saying that. I haven't heard that one yet. But we all know that there's the existence of this universe and ourselves and everything. Well, we either believe that came from something, or we believe that came from nothing. I mean, is there any other choice? Can you not have a belief about the existence of everything? You have to choose. You have to believe it either came from something, and the ultimate creator of all that we believe in, is the source of it all, is God. Or you have to believe that all of this something came from nothing. There's no other choice, is there? So which of those are we going to believe? So somebody that's going to mock us for believing in a God we've never seen. Well, has anybody ever seen or heard of something coming from nothing? Every example of something that exists, it has to come from something, doesn't it? We all right? Oh, okay. All right. Where do we have something that comes from nothing? I mean, nothing comes from nothing, right? If you start with zero, what do you end up with? I mean, zero. And that's actually a scientific law. I mean, it's kind of interesting. The atheists who mock our... we don't have a hookup here. Is that our problem? That's our problem. I knew something was going on here.
You were whispering about your blessing.
Yeah, I don't know. So like, what did I say wrong? All right. We have a hookup now. So as we're considering James chapter 2, 14 through 26 and about faith, because that second half of the chapter is about faith, a faith that has to have works. Well, we're comparing it to the latter part of chapter 1 of James that taught us that we have to hear and do. So we have the two components that have to go together, hearing and doing, where in James 2 it's believing, having faith, and working, obeying, belief and obedience. So regarding faith and where it comes from, in general, making the point that everybody believes things. And even atheists who mock us or Christians for believing in God, well, they believe, they have a system of belief themselves. They have to believe that everything that exists came from nothing. And they also have to believe that life originated from what is non-living, don't they? I remember that really well. The very first biology class, and when I went to college and I was a 18-year-old freshman and go to my first college class downtown here at USC, and big auditorium, 200 and some odd students in there for this lecture, and the learned professor and all with his PhD and all this comes in and puts his book on the lectern, and this is before they had PowerPoints and all that stuff, but anyway, and puts it down there on this podium, and everybody's giving rapt attention, and he started with the first lecture, first words out of his mouth, I don't even know if he said good morning, but anyway, he said, "You've heard of the theory of evolution." He says, "The evolution is not a theory, it's a fact," and he pounded that into the podium. I mean, those were the opening lines. So here's how they were taking the brand new freshman biology majors and to make sure, I mean, he was making sure he was going to hammer out immediately, first thing, any idea that was in anybody's head in there that evolution as is taught in, and this is pure secularism, the belief that everything that exists is natural and that it's not from God, it's not created. I mean, that was the point of emphasis from the beginning, to get that out of anybody's heads right there, then and there. So then everything else they could build after that. But he started with those lines, and then he began with the so-called Big Bang, where it all came from. And of course, he omitted. Well, how does something bang? How does nothing bang? If you have absolutely nothing present, can it bang? Can a vacuum bang? For an explosion to occur, something has to explode, doesn't it? And when they say a big bang, it's a big explosion, isn't it? Well, can you have nothingness explode? You have to have something there to explode, don't you? To have a big, and if it's a big bang, you really have to have a big something. I mean, all the mass in the universe, they're saying, originated from this explosion. So, I mean, think about that. Well, where did that original mass or whatever come from that banged and then led to all that we have? They like to omit that part, so there was no explanation of that original physical something or material something that they start with as just existing on its own. Where did that come from? What are the possibilities with that even? Well, it's either eternal and was always there. Has anybody ever heard of eternal matter? Nothing material is eternal. It's all temporal. It has a beginning and it has an end. So to think that there's going to that there's eternal matter is, but that's what they're forced into, to either believe that or that matter just poofed into existence out of nothing at all. Are there any other options for the beginning, the ultimate beginning of the existence of matter? It's either always been there or it came from nothing. Unless you believe God, of course, that he created it. But if you eliminate God from it, what are you left with? That it all came from absolutely nothing, or it's always been there, eternal? Which choice, what do you choose? What's the popular choice on that one, Jan, that they take? They just avoid that. I don't really hear anybody talk about that one. They try to avoid that. But anyway, he started, this professor of mine started from the Big Bang, as they always do, not before that. Like, what was there that banged? And so then he went from there with how all that led to the entire universe, all of the galaxies, the stars, the planets, Earth, and then what happened with how we got an atmosphere, and then supposedly where all these different molecules came from, and amino acids, and then with electricity that was in the atmosphere that somehow made proteins come together, and at some point all this life emerged, and then it evolved into from one cell to all that we have here. And when he finished that tale, which took the majority of the 50-minute lecture that day or whatever it was, I guess it was an hour and 15. That was a two-day-a-week class. So, I mean, he droned on for an hour with this stuff to give all the details, to make it sound so compelling that if you try to challenge any of it, you must be the biggest fool in the world. That was the point. But when he got to the end of it, he said the only missing link out of all of that was how the non-living became the living. He acknowledged that. He said that's the only piece that they can't explain. I so badly, even at that moment, wanted to blurt out, that's not a missing link, that's a missing chain, isn't it? I mean, that's not just some little piece that's missing. That's the whole thing. I mean, where did life come from? So, I mean, they've either got to say matter itself is eternal or it came from nothing, and then they have to say all that is all living things came from the non-living, which is... The other term for that is the spontaneous generation of life from non-living material. All right, I mean, those are things they have to believe. If you're going to reject God, you're forced to have a system of belief in those things. Just consider briefly, what evidence do we have of something coming from nothing? Zero. I mean, can anybody come up with an example where you start with absolutely nothing and you end up with something other than God creating the universe and everything in it? There is no example of that. Is there an example of matter that's eternal? Zero. Is there an example of the spontaneous generation of life, of living something, a living coming from the non-living? I mean, those are huge, huge points and positions that they have to take. They have, and they call us, they make fun of us saying we take a leap in the dark. But what are they doing? Think of the evidence. And now, do we believe that something came from nothing, or that something came from the original something, someone, the supreme being, the almighty and eternal God? And we believe that all life came from life and from the original life, our eternal God. All the examples we have are, you have to have something to have something. And you also have to have living, something alive for there to be life. I mean, that's called the law of biogenesis. I mean, these are scientific laws. It's so, all of the examples and the evidence for it is so strong and with absolutely no exceptions that those are called scientific laws. I mean, that's as strong as you can get. There's no refuting it. So they have to choose the system of belief that is, they have zero evidence for at all. Where what we're believing in is reasonable. It's reasonable to believe that there was life that created all this life, and that there was someone, a being, that made all of this, that it didn't come from nothing. Brother Dave? He spoke it into existence. He did. All the evidence supports what we believe on that. So they can mock us all they desire to, and they do. But they have a system of belief. That's the point here. Everybody believes something. Even the hardcore atheists, they follow a system of belief. Everybody believes things. Where does belief, faith, and whatever it is, where does it come from? Whatever it is, whether it's faith in God or faith in something else, it comes from hearing, doesn't it? Now, in 1 Corinthians chapter 2, verses 4 and 5, the Apostle Paul said his preaching and teaching was not with the enticing words of man's wisdom. He says that your faith should not stand in the wisdom of men. Where does faith... hearing the wisdom of men produces faith in what? The wisdom of men. We're going to believe what we're hearing. So we either listen to man, and I think I was probably the only one in that classroom that was not listening to. I mean, I heard the words, but I did not. I heard, but I did not believe what I was hearing from that professor of mine. I appreciate the fact that my father had done a lot of work to prepare me for what I was going to be hearing at that time. So I was ready for it, and I didn't believe any of that stuff he was saying. But I think just about every... I probably was the only one. Everybody else heard him and heard what he said and believed it. And they had faith. And that was the whole point of it. This guy was trying to create faith in what he was saying. He wanted everybody to believe that, to hear him and believe what he was saying. Well, he got it. He believed it. He didn't come up with that on his own. He heard that from somebody else, and he believed it. That's where. And who's the one ultimately behind all of this wisdom of men? The father of all lies. And that's the devil. So when we're listening to men, ultimately that means we're listening to the devil and his lies, when we're not listening, hearing God. But faith is, it is produced by hearing. So there's only one source of the right kind of faith in God. And Romans 10:17 tells us where that comes from. And where is it? Faith cometh by hearing, and hearing by the word of God. So in James chapter 1, from verses 22 down to verse 27, the emphasis is on we have to hear and do. Now in Genesis chapter 2, 14 through 26, it's faith that works. Well, that faith that we have comes from the hearing. Now, what's the difference between doing of chapter 1 and works of chapter 2? doing what we've heard from God's word versus believing and then doing the works of what we believe based on what we've heard. It's adding in what we have between chapter 1 and chapter 2 in James is the addition of that component of faith. It starts with the hearing, which was in James 1. I mean, James 1 was, in essence, it was presupposing the necessary faith that is going to be behind the doing. If we're hearing and doing, well, who's going to hear and then do if they don't believe it, what they've heard? But now he's putting the emphasis here on chapter 2 with that belief. Okay, if we hear and then believe it, I mean, if we hear God's word and we don't believe what we've heard from him and we reject that, I mean, are we going to do anything after that? No, that's going to be the end of it. That'll be the end of us, spiritually. But if we hear what God says and then we're convinced, that's really the ultimate definition of what faith is, that being convinced by argument. Well, here it's by God. We think of argument like a big fight or disagreement. No, it's setting forth his arguments, his positions, his teachings on all of these things that pertain to life and godliness. Well, we hear what God has presented to us on everything. When we hear that, then we're convinced by what he has said, and then that's where the faith is, and then we have to act upon that faith and do what he tells us to do with what he's teaching us to do. Now, if we hear but don't do, then our religion is in vain, according to chapter 1. If we hear and believe but don't work, don't obey, then that faith is what in chapter 2? It's dead. So is there a relationship between the points of teaching in James 1 and James 2? I mean, they are right there together. I mean, it's really the same point, but he's adding in and building on it here in chapter 2 with coming at it from the standpoint of faith, believing what we've heard from what God has said. What are we going to do with that? Are we going to do nothing? Only believe in our minds, or are we going to work and obey according to what he's taught us to do? I mean, God, is the scriptures just containing a bunch of information? I mean, there's obviously a lot of information in these scriptures, but what's the point of all the information? This is not just a collection of facts to memorize. This is information that ultimately calls us into some action. Lots of different actions. Things that we have to do. His commandments. His instructions. And all the information he gives us is to guide us into what we're supposed to do, how we're supposed to live. I mean, how do we have this book right here and hear the words and then not do anything? I mean, what do we have then? I mean, that's... What kind of religion is that? That we've just received the input of a lot of information from these pages. If we don't do anything with it, what is the point of it? There is zero point to it. I mean, that's what chapter 1 and chapter 2 is teaching us here. The entire purpose of what God has revealed to us is calling us to do what he says. Fulfill his will, his purpose. And if we don't, then we have a vain religion, and we're not going to heaven with a vain religion, and we're not going to heaven with a dead faith. So now he's, to get back to it, because we're near the end of this part of James 2, I'm near the end of the chapter, but as we've got down through verse 24 last week, so we've seen two examples that he's given thus far, starting with chapter 14, when he's been teaching the point that our faith has to have works in order to profit, and otherwise it's without it, it's dead. Well, he's given two examples. He's about to give us a third. So there's going to be three examples. Two are going to be in one category where the one is in the other. The first example that he gave us that we're not supposed to follow, to recognize but not be like, verse 19, what was the first example that he gave here in this passage? The example of faith without works. Belief without obedience, which is the same thing. What was the example there in James 2:19? Who is the shining example of believing but not doing?
The devils.
And if we believe and don't do, then that's the category we're in. Then we're identified as being a child of the devil. And we looked at 1 John 3:10 last week, and this are manifest the children of God and the children of the devil. What's going to reveal that? He that doeth righteousness and loveth his brother is revealed as a child of God. And he who doesn't is identified as a child of the devil. That's all about the doing, isn't it? Based on what we've heard. Who's the one? Where have we heard that we're supposed to do what is right? And who's the one that defines what is right? That's God. That's what is contained, especially in the gospel of Christ. It is the power of God unto salvation. Therein is revealed the righteousness of God from faith to faith. That's where we find it. But if we don't do what is, if we just hear what God says is right and don't do it, then who, we're revealed to be whose child? The devil's. That's the point of 1 John 3:10. That's the point of James 2:19. Same point, both places. To be God's child, we have to hear what he says and then do it. So we have to do what's right, and how much of what's right is involved with loving one another? Well, much of it, such that Jesus said, everything hangs on our love for God and love for one another. Everything else hangs on that. So here in James chapter 2, verse 19, he gives the example of the devils who believe but don't obey. And if we believe and don't obey, that's who we're like. So then he gave us an example from verses 21 through 24 of someone, a great example of someone who believed and demonstrated his faith by works, by obeying God. And what example did we study from those verses? Such that it's the opposite of, in fact, it's the very one, we mentioned this last week, in John chapter 8, where he identified those leaders of the Jews who said, we be Abraham's seed, and we're never in bondage to any man. When they were rejecting Christ, Jesus said, you're of your father the devil, in John 8:44. But they said, we be Abraham's seed, but he said, you're Abraham's seed, but you're not children of Abraham, because if you were children of Abraham, you would do the works of Abraham, but you do the works of your father. And he says, you're of your father the devil. So who is given by Jesus himself as being the opposite? We're either the children of the devil or spiritually the children of whom? Abraham. So just as Abraham was given as the opposite of the devil by Christ in John 8, we find the exact same thing here in James 2. Abraham on one side, the devil on the other. Now, as far as Abraham is concerned, how good is that to be used over and over by God as being the opposite of the devil? How well does that speak of Abraham? That's a man we really need to know and follow, because spiritually, to be a child of God is going to mean we're a child of Abraham too. That's why he was called the friend of God and the father of all those who have faith. I mean, that is rare to be in that category. But that's why he gives that example there with Abraham. He's going to give us another one here now in verse 25 of James 2. So he says, likewise, Also, was not Rahab the harlot justified by works when she had received the messengers and had sent them away out another way? So how many examples in James 2 does he give of a living faith, a faith that worked, that obeyed? Two, Abraham and Rahab. I mean, for Rahab to be included right here with Abraham as one of the two examples of this that he chooses here in James 2, I mean, what does that also say about Rahab and her faith? Now, does this mean there are only two examples that have ever existed of a living faith, of ones who had faith that worked? No. He's giving these two. A little bit last week, but especially the week before, we spent quite a bit of time in what chapter that, not by happenstance, includes these very same two examples, but a bunch of other ones that by faith did whatever the things are that he was pointing out, they did, the works they did from their faith. Which chapter contains that great cloud of witnesses of many examples of it? And such that even says there wasn't space to keep going with it. He had really started with Abel and finished with David by name. But there were a lot more after that. We've been studying on Sunday mornings. We've got a man, Hezekiah, that's got, 11 chapters in the Old Testament that are between 2 Kings, 2 Chronicles, and Isaiah, 11 chapters about his life and his example. He's not even mentioned at all in Hebrews 11 by name. I mean, the things that he says to summarize the ones that he didn't have space to keep going by name there obviously includes him. But I'm just mentioning Hezekiah. We're studying him on Sunday mornings at the moment. He's certainly one of the great examples of one who had faith and work, even though he's not called by name in Hebrews 11. So Hebrews 11 has a lot of them. That's the chapter. I guess I just gave the answer to my question. But anyway, yeah, Hebrews chapter 11 gives all those examples there of ones who had faith, but out of their faith. I mean, how many examples are given in Hebrews 11 of people that believed but didn't do anything? How many examples of dead faith are in Hebrews 11? None, obviously. I mean, everyone by faith, and it'll name them and tell what they did. I mean, they had faith and they worked. They did out of their faith the will of God. And then he gives the specific examples of that. I mean, Noah was commanded to build an ark. He didn't say, "Right, Lord, I believe there's going to be this flood and everything, and I believe you exactly with how this ark should be built, but I'm not doing it." I mean, that would be no example. I mean, he would have drowned too if that was him, right? I mean, but obviously that was not Noah. I mean, he believed what God said and showed it by doing exactly what he said with no deviation from what God instructed him. And all those other ones that he gives there. But so this is much briefer than Hebrews 11. He could have used any or all of those examples and then some here in James 2. He could have used all the examples or any of the examples from the entire Bible here to prove this point, but he happened to choose two. It should be no surprise to us that he chose Abraham. It might be a little surprising that of the second one that he chose Rahab. She's mentioned in Hebrews 11 also, but she's mentioned here. The fact that Rahab is found by name in Hebrews 11 and James 2, that says something about her and her faith, doesn't it? I mean, let's consider that, because this is no small point that he's using her as an example. There's a lot to learn. Good things to learn from her example there. So Rahab was another one who had faith and out of her faith did something. So going back to the book of Joshua, because that's where we read about Rahab. Joshua chapter 2. So we're introduced to Rahab right here in the first verse. But in Joshua chapter 2, verse 1, it says, "And Joshua the son of Nun sent out of Shittim two men to spy secretly, saying, 'Go view the land, even Jericho.' And they went and came into a harlot's house named Rahab and lodged there." So here are the two spies that are sent out by Joshua. And they were sent specifically to Jericho. Why there? That was the first city of Canaan that was going to fall and be given to the children of Israel by the Lord. So they were about to cross the Jordan River. I mean, they've spent 40 years now after the Exodus from Egypt wandering in the wilderness, and finally they've come up on the east side of Jordan, and they conquered, and this was before Moses' death, when they defeated Sihon and Og, and they took Bashan and Gilead, all that land on the east side of Jordan. So everything that was between Syria to the north and Ammon and Moab to the south, on that east side of the Jordan River, the children of Israel took that, and that was reserved to be an inheritance for 2.5 tribes of the children of Israel that requested their inheritance to be in that land. It was good for cattle. That was Reuben, Gad, and half the tribe of Manasseh. They were told that they could have that, but before they could inherit, they had to, as their brethren had helped fight with them to obtain that and conquer that, which was on the east side of Jordan, they were going to have to go with all their brethren and conquer everything on the other side, on the west side of the Jordan River, I guess, from your standpoint, over here. But anyway, they were going to have to do that, and then they would all conquer together, and then they would inherit together afterwards. And that's what happened. But Moses was not allowed to lead the children of Israel across the Jordan River into the land of Canaan proper. He was shown that from Mount Pisgah, and God showed him all the land from there. And then Joshua was the one chosen to be the successor of Moses. And he's the one that led the children of Israel to cross the Jordan. But they haven't all gone across yet. He sends these spies across first to go into Jericho, which is near there. It's not far from the river. And so that's going to be the first city that they attack. So, of course, it had its mighty walls around it, which would prove to be absolutely zero obstacle for God, of course. But the spies were sent in there to see what was there. And they lodged at the house of Rahab. Now, Rahab's, what she had done for her profession is mentioned there in verse 1. I mean, Rahab had been a harlot. And we even read in James chapter 2 when it mentions Rahab, she's referred to there as Rahab what? The Rahab the harlot. That itself reminds us of something. Now, is she going to be condemned to hell because of the harlotry that she engaged in prior to her following Jehovah? Is that wickedness and her sins from before, is she going to lose her soul because of those sins? No. Did this woman repent? I mean, here she is being used in Hebrews 11 as one of the examples, part of our great cloud of witnesses of a living faith. And here she is right there in James 2, right after Abraham, as an example of one who had a living faith. I mean, Rahab's going to heaven. I hope that's not a news flash for anybody in here. But in spite of her past, but she obviously repented. But what does that also tell about sin? And it can be something large or something that we've lived in or done along those lines, but maybe something smaller, but whatever. I mean, One of the problems with sin, and there are a lot of scriptures on that, we're not going to go through an entire search of that right now, but we can certainly see that with in the case of Rahab. But can we have our reputation, as far as our earthly reputation, permanently stained or damaged because of a choice or choices that we've made, where we have fall into temptation and engaged in sin? And there's some things that we can't outlive in this life. That can be a problem, can't it? And we can see that with Rahab. I mean, as far as that, what she lived in, I mean, that went forever with her name, as far as on this earth. Now we're all going to be given a new name in heaven, and her name, she's not going to be Rahab the harlot in heaven. But it does remind us, though, of what sin can do, as far as how it can do great damage to our name, to our reputation, and it's hard to get that back if it's lost, isn't it? So it's a reminder of that, but that's not the point that he's trying to show us about Rahab, what the errors that she committed, the sins that she had committed prior to all of this. That was her background. I mean, that is a fact. But she's not going to continue in that. In fact, what are we going to know from what happens later? It's not going to be here in Joshua chapter 2, but while we're on the subject, you can read Matthew chapter 1, you can read Christ's lineage in other places. Jesus Christ was a descendant of Rahab. What kind of honor was God showing to Rahab that not only did he save her, have her included as part of his people, but ultimately brought his son, Jesus Christ, of course, he's introduced in Matthew 1 as the son of Abraham, the son of David, but it gives his lineage there, and it includes Rahab. It also includes Ruth, who was a Moabitess. Here was a woman that had, what was her background? Idolatry. But that's not what she remained. I mean, she did not remain Ruth the idolatress. That was her background. But it is interesting to see some that the Lord chose, especially some of those women that God chose to be ancestors of his son, as far as his physical lineage when he would be born into this world. I mean, he showed great honor to Rahab and to Ruth in those cases in bringing Christ through them. I mean, he was definitely showing them great favor because of the faith that they had in the Lord. I mean, Rahab and Ruth are great examples of faith. They overcame their background. They overcame the sins that they had been involved in their younger years. Rahab repented of the harlotry. Ruth repented of the idolatry. And to the point we know that Ruth, when had the opportunity to go back to all of that, and she resolutely refused. She left her own land, the only place that she'd ever known. I mean, in that sense, she did a lot like Abraham had done, but she left her land and all of her people because all of that represented idolatry, and that's exactly why God called Abraham out of away from his place. But Ruth willingly followed Naomi, her mother-in-law, to go to Israel because that she was a follower of God, the God of heaven, and she was not going to change from that at that point. Well, Rahab didn't either. I mean, Rahab, as we're going to see with all of this, she was saved, she and her family, and that was, of all the ones in Jericho, they were the only ones spared because of this faith that she had. And then she became part of the nation of Israel, married one of them, and became an ancestor of Christ, and is used in Hebrews 11 by name and in James 2 as an example of a living faith. So even though we can stain our name with sin in this life, whatever, however bad anybody may have been, can we be recovered from that? Can we repent of that? Can we have a different outcome or future than whatever, however bad or lowly things were before? I mean, Rahab is a great example of that, one of the best. Yes. That's right. I mean, there were several generations between Rahab and Boaz, but that was his ancestry, which he would have known. And I mean, he knew he came from someone who had that kind of background, but became one of the most righteous women that served the Lord of that nation. That she was not of. I mean, she was not an Israelite herself, physically or ethnically, just like Ruth was not. But God received them because of their faith and their living faith, their obedient faith. And yes, Boaz would be a great example of that, descended from one and then descended from Rahab, married Ruth because he was looking at her heart. So wonderful examples they are. But the spies went in there to her house. Now, normally, if you got, here's this nation amassed at the Jordan River. They have conquered all of that land and on the east side of the Jordan. And she's going to, they all know this. Now, here they are about to cross the river. They know all that happened going back 40 years before with their exodus from Egypt. They know all about that. They know the history of this people from this last 40 years, from when they left Egypt and their bondage there and how they came out, how they got out of Egypt, and then what they've done on the east side of Jordan and what God did for them. Now, Rahab is, of course, making the connection that this God did all of this for them, and God was on their side. And as a result, she wanted to be on God's side because that was going to be, otherwise, she was going to be on the losing side, and she would have been dead. But she knew that, and so she understood that God was with them. But ordinarily, in a place like that, here you have an invader on your doorstep that has already done much in conquering, and you're obviously next, and then you have a couple of spies come in there from among them. I mean, if Rahab were like a regular citizen of any place, what would she have done when she got those spies? Yeah, I mean, you can put it in modern time. I mean, what would happen if somebody in Ukraine got some Russian spies that showed up at their house? What are they going to do? What would anybody do anywhere if you think about it? And by human reckoning, see, Rahab is not, I mean, this would be somebody that, she would immediately report this to the authorities, wouldn't she? To try to help save her city and her people. And she could have been it wouldn't have worked, so she wouldn't have lived long enough to be a heroine to the people of Jericho, because then they would all died and she with them all. But, I mean, that's the way people think about these things. Now, from if this history that we're reading here were written by Jerichoans, I don't know if that's the right term for it, but anyway, there weren't any people from there that survived this, so they couldn't write the history. But if they wrote the history, if they'd lived, then what would Rahab have gone down in Jericho as far as the annals of their history? Rahab would have been labeled what? Not to the people of Jericho for hiding the spy. No, if she had. I mean, with what she actually did. Yes, she would have been considered one of the greatest. If the people of Jericho could have written their own history, if they'd survived all of what actually happened, Rahab would have been, she would have been their Benedict Arnold. I mean, most nations have a name that kind of goes with that. So we have ours. Everybody knows Benedict Arnold. She would have been their Benedict Arnold, wouldn't you? I mean, she would have been considered a great traitor to her people. But was she committing treason? Well, maybe by their definition, maybe by man's definition. But this wasn't a matter of choosing nation versus nation and rejecting her own nation or people for another. That was not the case. This was a choice between what and what? Good and evil. Righteousness, wickedness. God or not God. I mean, that's what this choice was. She was choosing the Lord and to believe in and serve God over man. So the way God looks at Rahab and teaches us about Rahab, it's an exactly opposite from the way her own people would have with what she did, isn't it? She was doing righteously, not wickedly. The people of Jericho would have considered her deeds here to be wicked in hiding these spies and not revealing them to her people. But the fact was, God was going to give that city to Israel, and she knew it. She knew this was God's work, and she chose the Lord. So it tells us in the rest of chapter 2 about what she did in hiding the spies, but we're going to have to leave them hidden for the next week. Lord willing, we'll let them escape from her roof and do what they had to do next Wednesday night. So we do appreciate everybody being here tonight and look forward to continuing our study. We should finish up James 2, Lord willing, next week. But it's worth our time to go through some detail about this example of Rahab that the Lord has given to us.